When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, my name's Julie Rugg from the Cemetery Research Group at the University of York here in the UK, and I'm delighted, very delighted, to be talking to Professor Christine Bakuska from the Tennessee State University. And I'm going to really mispronounce where you come from. Murfreesboro?
Is that
Murfreesboro?
Right? Yeah.
Murfreesboro. Thank you. And Christine is Professor of History, Folklore and Ethnomusicology at the University and a former co-director of the Oral History Association. I'm absolutely delighted to introduce this book. It's called Just Enough to Put Him Away Decent, Death Care, Life Extension, and the Making of a Healthier South, 1900 to 1955. And for me, this book covers so many different, exciting and interesting areas of history over that period. And I kind of want to start with a really kind of general question. I think this book, it weaves together so many interesting threads. It's got oral history in there, the history of public health, religion, and theology is part of that, and this broad kind of history of the South. Did one particular thread draw you into this book, or was it lots of things together that helped you sort of think about this book as was this one big project?
Well, it actually started with a cemetery back in 2000. I had just moved to Murfreesboro, had taken the job at Middle Tennessee State University, and I was driving down this road, and right in the middle of suburbia, there's a major cemetery right smack dab in the middle of town. Now, that may be different for your listeners or for the cemetery research group folks, but in where I grew up in San Francisco, we have a city of the dead called Colma, California. Mm-hmm. Joe DiMaggio's buried there. My aunt, the nun, is buried there. But it's set away. It's hidden. And here I was in Murfreesboro, and right in the middle of town, there's this huge cemetery with really interesting funereal statuary. And so I finished my first book so I could get tenure and all of that. And then I started applying for money to talk about death. And I was very surprised on where it led me, because it wasn't necessarily about the end, but the road to the end. Meaning, just because that cemetery existed didn't mean, at least in the 20th century, that you should be in it sooner rather than later. And what I found was that the South was a place particularly associated within American consciousness nationally as a place that was quite deadly. And at a time where there was no way to know that, I can't tell you if that's true or not. What I can tell you is that perception became at least the initial impetus for folks to begin to say, when do we die? How should we die? And who cares for us at death?
So it's really, I think that the thing about the book that's so fascinating is it's kind of drawing together, and this doesn't happen very often, this history of health and life extension is a really interesting way you put it, and this history of death and this tension that sits within the life insurance people that actually we want you to live as long as possible because it's not profitable for you to die early.
Yeah. So it's not just the insurance. So insurance agents and burial societies were really dominant in the South, particularly amongst Black communities. The Black burial societies go back to the enslaved eras. I found one in 1743 in Charleston, South Carolina. And but what happened in the 20th century with World War I and the expansion of industrial practices, something had, you know, the guns and bombs are gone by 1918 or 1919. So what do you do with all that industrial heft? And the answer was invested in making goods. And one of the sets of goods that became really commercialized, expanded, expensive, was funeral goods. And so one of my favorite parts of the book is talking about the ladies in Memphis, the Black women who were working class, who went to work every day wearing what their employers required them, usually a gray or black outfit. And here they are buying themselves purple coffins. And
that's remarkable. Yeah.
Yeah. And in, as you know, in Protestant theology, purple is the color of royalty. And I imagine these ladies going to work and imagining that moment where they get to be laid out in that purple coffin. Mm-hmm. And but this stuff was expensive. Mm-hmm. So it's not only the coffin, it's the dress and the hearse ride in the Cadillac hearse. Mm-hmm. In an era of racial segregation on cable cars and stuff, there you are in a Cadillac and your family's there. Mm-hmm. And Southern thinking in the 20th century, and I would argue a little bit now, people didn't think they went to heaven until they were actually on the ground.
Right.
So these ladies thought they would be at their funerals and see themselves.
Right.
With a lot of love. Uh-huh. The thing was, though, you know, many of the, you know, they would first of all pay the burial man or the insurance man first before eating. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't have one or two policies. There's a Charleston, a Black Charleston funeral home that had a book set aside for just to list the number of policies. And you were averaging 4, 5, 6, 8 in some cases. And so the burial societies, not as much. They're more about ritual. Mm-hmm. But the insurance companies, whether it was a white insurance company or a Black one, said, hey, the longer these folks live, these coffins are paid for. Mm-hmm. But I also think there were shifts in theology that are especially apparent with the Southern Baptist Convention, which is the Southern Baptist organizing body.
Yeah.
The South didn't have very many hospitals or very much medical care at all. And when I moved, and it was the churches that ended up paying for the first really big hospitals in the South. So when I moved to Nashville, Baptist Hospital and Methodist Hospital were downtown.
Yeah.
And so I went to the Southern Baptist Convention archives, which are in Nashville. And there's all this literature in their annual convention report saying, this is the hospital that we funded in this state. This is the hospital that we funded in this state. We're going to set aside special deacons, a deaconess ship for women to go and minister to these people, because the longer somebody lived, the longer you had to get them to accept Jesus.
Right.
And if you accepted Jesus, you would get, as according to John 14:2 in the King James Bible, which is the standard for the heir, in my house there are many mansions. I'm probably that you don't get to go to the house with your family reunion until you've accepted Jesus.
Yeah.
And so by keep building these hospital rooms, letting people live longer, ministering to them, this was seen as necessary to evangelical Christianity in the 20th century.
This is really interesting, isn't it? Because I'm thinking about the UK and thinking about where this connection in terms of health and spiritual wealth, you know, how they connect, simply doesn't happen in the UK. We don't make that connection. And it's interesting it happens in the US. And one of the things, I was talking to somebody about it this morning, I was thinking, you know, the size of congregations that we're talking about, they're, you know, the congregation sizes allow for the accrual of that much wealth to be able to fund the opening of hospitals.
To an extent, you know, a good Baptist, and I'm coming from an Episcopal, as your listeners would know, Anglican belief. So our belief system is a little different. But in the Baptist faith, tithing, and Methodist too, tithing is crucial.
Right.
But they redefined what that tithe did. So there's a financial basis that is pretty solid for a lot of these hospitals. That doesn't get and the cost of running these hospitals does not get recognized until after World War II, when the federal government passed some bills, Hill-Burton Act, and I think 1955, that said, we'll give you money to build these hospitals, but you got to take care of some folks who are lower income. There's a massive expansion in hospitals because of that.
Right.
But by that time, according to Americans, and the shift came in the 1930s. It had become a right of citizenship, American citizenship, to live a relatively long and healthy life. This is the Social Security Act of 1935, 101 here. And so this sense that there should be others besides the Baptist and the Methodist or the insurance companies or the burial societies, which built their own hospitals. That the federal government saw this as a right of citizenship for being an American.
Awesome. It's kind of fascinating to think about, but you're covering such a lot of literal space in terms of the group of states you're covering, and also a remarkable number of people, you know, the oral history element of it. I really liked, because often death scholars, I'm quite like, for my own sort of historical sort of understanding, is to delve into what's ordinary, not what's atypical and different, but just thinking, what is the ordinary experience? What is, somebody like me 100 years ago, what are they thinking about the world? You know, how they see the world? And that you seem to have tapped into an extraordinary wealth of oral histories. I mean, how did that come about? Is this information so routinely available to, I know that you're, attached to the Oral History Association.
Yeah. Well, this idea of ordinariness, I mean, that's the title, 101. I was going through some oral interviews that I'll tell you about in just a second. And this one woman from 1939 said, well, her husband was one of the first aviators in the Savannah, Georgia area. And she was remembering his death about 15 years later to an oral interviewer. And she said, he left two burial policies that were just enough to put him away decent. And that vernacular, ordinariness, to put somebody away decent, that's the ordinary. It's not the beautiful second line in the New Orleans funeral procession, or it's the ladies dressing up in black and then gray in the antebellum South. So the ordinariness is essential, I think, because, and to find that ordinariness, one way was with oral histories. Now, there's a lot of documents, death scholars, at least the way I do it, well, and the way you do it too, with the cemetery projects, we have more than enough documents, right?
Well, I don't know, actually. I think we've had a very, in the UK, there's been a tendency to see the 20th century as a place where death wasn't talked about. And this is a very common misconception. And
which means
a lot of scholars haven't gone looking for it. And I know that this is a history that's yet to be written. This is a huge history that we've not written yet. And I think people's day-to-day experience will encompass mortality. And they will be talking about it with each other.
But so
I find it frustrating, but also I'm delighted that you've demonstrated that you can draw all of these things into a history of mortality very easily.
Yeah, it just takes a long time. So let me tell you about these oral histories. Certainly, I did a bunch on my own, and I did a bunch with some, I have some National Institutes of Health money to do some research projects. And it funded an oral history project with the National Funeral Directors and Morticians Association, which is the Black, historically Black Funeral Directors Society. Wonderful people to talk to, very helpful. But I wanted to know about everyday people, not people who were in the business. And back in the 1930s, during the New Deal and the Great Depression, the same processes and the governmental practices that passed the Social Security Act of 1935 also said between 1936 and 1940, let's go do oral interviews. They're called life histories, and they come out of the Works Progress Administration. Any of your listeners can Google WPA Life Histories, and the Library of Congress website will come up. So these are accessible to anybody. And what I did is there are thousands of them, because these folks went from state to state to state, not every state, but, you know, limiting my view to the South. Mm-hmm. There were hundreds of people talking about death and talking about health. And the thing that's interesting about these life histories, it's part of the Federal Writers Project, which is a subset of the WPA. And the WPA was redefining American democracy. It wasn't about businessmen or great politicians. We would get back to an equitable economic system if we invested, Americans said at the time, in the common man, and we would say common man and woman. Mm-hmm. And the common man and woman had stories to tell. And so that was the impetus for these oral histories. So this vernacular about just enough to put them away decent comes from those oral histories. And because, you know, lots of different interviewers would find people. It kept writers in business so they wouldn't starve, like Margaret Walker, who wrote the book Jubilee, or Ralph Ellison, or Anza Yezerska. And you can see those. They list the authors out. And so what it allows you to do, because they're not remembering 1936, they go all the way back to the 1850s.
Right.
This is also, as an aside, this is also where the enslaved narrative come from.
Yeah.
This same project. Mm-hmm. But what I was able to do with these oral histories is begin in rural areas. Mm-hmm. And see the deaf practices as so much a part of the everyday lives that it was hard to tease them out.
Right.
Because it was so routine. Mm-hmm. These, you know, and I would, Julie, I would say that death isn't not talked about, but it's talked about as a special case. Mm-hmm. And what I had to do is look for the ways that it transformed, not to something everybody talked about, but to something mm-hmm. nobody talked about, but the ways it was part and common to being special and unique. Mm-hmm. And just as an aside, Southerners talk about the dead all the time. The dead don't die here. Mm-hmm. They put a chair out and tell them mm-hmm. to come sit down, and, you know, mm-hmm. the dead are still there.
It's interesting the way you're talking about it, because I think there's a sense in which there might be a feeling, oh, you know, at what point do you ask somebody about death and funerals? And it's not like that people are actually, this is something they routinely talk about, it's part of their life experience, and they don't have to be asked to introduce it. They feel quite comfortable about talking about that particular subject. And I suppose that's where sometimes oral history people might think, oh, can we ask about these things? We'd have to fill out ethics forms about whether we're going to distress somebody or not by talking about it. You know, we create little boundaries about things that we think we shouldn't talk about. And I think sometimes people are actually quite willing to talk about things given a very open sort of field to sort of think about. It sounds really that you have so much material to come out. I think I was also interested how you've managed to pull out from that some of the undertaking business information. Did that come from your oral history funeral director respondents, or were they business records that were available that you were able to look at?
I did do one oral history with a man named John C. Scarborough III, who was the third generation of funeral directors in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. And let me say as an aside, in the United States, oral history is exempt from any institutional review boards or any ethics stuff. So we can ask questions. There, I walked into an interview, you know, the ones that I did at one point, and the guy started talking for the next 3 hours. And what he wanted to talk to me about is the fact that his mother, who was nuts, tried to kill him by slitting his throat when he was 4 years old. And so there's a catharsis of sorts for some people. So to your question about undertaking, so there were oral history, WPA life histories. I did some, but the undertakers had a tendency to be business records. And you could follow the business from rural consumers all the way to in the early 1900s, all the way to battlefields across the globe at the end of World War II. And the date for the book ending is 1955. And that's when the last American bodies that they could find came home. Okay, now they're still finding bodies, as they are in England still too. But it's on those, in particular, the ledgers, the funeral ledgers. And ledgers in the South have a special meaning because if you think about the sharecropping system, which gave rise to, for example, to blues music, ledgers were tools of exploitation and power plays. And the language in the South is, well, I didn't have the pencil.
Right.
The person with the pencil gets to mark whether something is paid or not and whether something is owed. And if you had the pencil, you could say something to the effect of, well, you owe me money. You'll have to stay another year on my land and maybe you can make it next year. And so here are these ledgers that have such profound depth and meaning in the South that become common around 1910, 1915.
Okay.
And it's very much part of that progressive reform movement in the United States, where if you give order to something, you can, because it's all chaotic. If you give order to it by filling out paperwork, then you can figure out what the chaos is and solve it. The chaos in this case is death that causes the death that caused people to die very young. And you see that on the funeral ledgers because they begin as so-and-so bought the coffin for so-and-so for their kid. That's it. Okay. So it's very, very minimal at first. Here's the medal for a casket that was handmade. But then you see it evolve and you see the practices, the progressive practices evolve. What kind of information do you want now? So it could be two lines and then it becomes 15 lines. And these ledgers are treasure troves for genealogists because they list parents.
Do they? And this is just an aside, and I know it's an interruption. Did they start to? I know one of the things that's really interesting looking in the UK is how businesses start to use pre-printed ledgers. Which then gives them all of these cells they have to fill in, and that makes them so much more valuable, doesn't it?
Yeah, and so in the United States, it was one that was printed in St. Louis, Missouri, called the American Funeral Ledger. And the American Funeral Ledger that it put things in, you know, and by the 1930s, airplane travel. The Southern didn't do that, you know. By the 1940s, there would be a line for your Social Security number. And so the ledgers themselves are these intrusions into healthcare, because how did the person die? Let's count all the causes of death and then resolve it. And the states helped out by passing laws that said required death certificates, but the last death certificates in the South were obligated until 1932. And I think that was Texas. So these what were called death registration areas, the South was late to the game because it required the legislation and then it required the people to buy into it. And there a good guess at best. Mm-hmm. You know, I have students who have told me they have people buried babies. Mm-hmm. All right, this may be a little awkward for some folks, but, you know, stillborn babies that were taken out and never recorded and buried in the backyard, and that was it. Mm-hmm. So they're a good guess at best.
Yeah.
I think the
other thing that's really interesting is actually, because I always think about funeral directing as being three things. It's all of the kind of like legalities.
Yes.
It's all of the purchases, and it's also how you put on the event. You know, it's like a performance, isn't it? And I think for me, it's always interesting to think about how over time, what's thought to be the necessary things you need to buy.
Yeah.
Kind of changes, doesn't it? We talked about the purple sort of caskets as being quite an interesting sort of element. Do you get a sense in which over the time period you're looking at, what was required in terms of what you purchased for your funeral also changed over time?
Well, I think yes, you do get that from the ledgers, and the ledgers are everywhere. Some of them have been published. Some of them are in archives. They're just a remarkable, there's so many of them. Again, if you want to know who your family reunion is, then you do your genealogy, and the funeral ledgers help you write that genealogy.
Right.
Okay. What is necessary at first is somebody else to provide handcrafted goods, because the funeral bodies, the coffins were handmade but by the late 1890s, early 1900s, you start to see nameplates. Mm-hmm. So let me tell your audience something about cemeteries in the South, that each family had its own cemetery, sometimes on its land. And this family cemetery was typically within view of the front porch. And so where I grew up in San Mateo County, California, we had one place with a bunch of cemeteries in it. But in the county I live in now, Rutherford County, Tennessee, there are more than 600 cemeteries in this county.
Right.
Because each family had its own funeral, its own cemetery. And it was purposeful after the Civil War, well, before the Civil War too, but after the Civil War, when houses blew down in a tornado, when land, because of all the economic depression of, you know, you have human beings that you purchased as commodities and the commodities leave, how do you make a claim to the land as being yours? You bury a body on it. And the body was supposed to decompose and mix the family's body with the land and make it intrinsically theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What's interesting is that there were no cemetery stones, very few cemetery stones, except for the wealthiest people. Mm-hmm. And instead, memory and do you have peonies in York? It's a kind of flower.
A flower, yeah.
Flowering bush. Or cedar trees here in Rutherford County. We have a lot of cedar. You would plant them on the grave, and it was the plants that marked the bodies, which was problematic later on. But it was expensive. It was time intensive, and bodies were buried without being embalmed. And so people from rural areas started going to the cities, and you see them buying first a nameplate made of metal, which is going to last in the dirt, and the casket handles.
Mm-hmm.
And then they buy the casket. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, they're buying more things. And they're political choices. Again, we go back to the hearse ride to the cemetery, where a group of people were told they had to sit in the back of the bus or the cable car or whatever. Here they are, in a Cadillac hearse with the top down, if it wasn't raining, so people would see them in this elegance.
Mm-hmm.
And so these funeral purchases are just phenomenal because of that. Can you see that?
I mean, it's interesting because I think you were talking about flowers as well, and people photographing the flower displays being really quite elaborate. I mean, did the floral industry you know, did it really respond to that demand? Was it a very specific kind of business that then grew in response to that demand?
So yes and no. Yes, and that, yeah, you know, if you look at old maps of Murfreesboro, and they're within a relatively small area, there are three florists with their own greenhouses. Right. But in the South, as a friend of mine said to me once, the backbone of white Southern femininity in the South is the garden club.
Oh, but
and so all if you were a fine Southern woman, black or white, you had a garden and you had flowers. And so one of the things that you see in the condolence literature, or the cards that were saved, because people would present a card when they came in to express grief, it would write down the flowers that were left. And you could tell the time of the year, you know, if it's June, they're going to be gladiolas.
Right.
Never carnations. So the press, bless their heart, the first cover came with a carnation on it.
Oh,
and,
right.
And another friend of mine said, oh, no, 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 no. And so it's a pity.
Oh, tell me why. Why? About
because it's considered kind of garish.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I like carnations personally, but yeah. But in the South you don't do that. And so so we had a conversation about let's do another kind of flower.
Right.
Yeah. A friend of mine who's in her 50s, she's got a long time yet. She said, I've already told my florist no carnations.
Right. Okay. Well, we have a similar thing with lilies, which is sort of like people say, lilies funeral flower. We don't want any lilies.
Yes.
It's sort of like, it's a similar kind of thing. Really interesting thing, thinking about, I mean, it's one of the things that you draw on, thinking about Emily Post and these etiquette books that start to sort of then talk about what people should and shouldn't be doing. You were talking about, that seemed that's a little too much, but this is appropriate. Really interesting source to use, I think.
Yeah, the etiquette books, especially since Emily Post was so popular in the 1920s. And the argument I make in the book that there are three theoretical, if you will, gurus or intellectual gurus of the 20s. Freud, Havelock Ellis, who's British, and Emily Post. But Emily Post is the one people know because she was in the newspaper, she was on the radio, she wrote books that were very accessible. So the average person can't read Freud in his original stuff. And he's writing about grief in the 1920s. But what Emily Post, who was a Southerner, she was from Maryland, did was she took those ideas and rendered them into a system by which, okay, this is what's good and this is what you shouldn't do. Now, some of the Southern, you know, there's a lot of about calm demeanor. They're very worried about melancholy, which is a Freudian term. That too much emotion, too much grief, too much crying, that's really bad and you have to avoid that. So let's put in some practices to make sure people don't venture down that end, except that it's the South. And so what's the really nifty, just a really remarkable document, you know, you just go in and start Googling terms about death, condolence, all of this. And at the University of South Carolina, there was a 2-volume diary, journal, if you will, by a woman named Nell Melishop. And Nell's sister, Amelia, died in 1925 of breast cancer. And Nell kept a grief journal about her for the next 17 years. And it's 2 volumes. And it's just, I mean, it's a pure example of melancholy because she writes every day. She pastes in cards and notes, letters, and this poor woman needed some psychotherapy and some Zoloft.
Absolutely clings to her grief, doesn't she? Becomes part of her identity.
Yeah, to a point where her Episcopal bishop says, "Why don't you go try get some sleep?" And that letter is posted into the journal and stuff too. So the ritual isn't perfect by any means, and this is a family, very elite white family in Columbia, South Carolina. Lots of, you know, the funeral was at home still. embalmed and all of that. And it just, it's a document with a lot of shame and a lot of grief in it. And that's not what Emily Post was shooting for. She was trying to move people away from that.
It was interesting, though, isn't it? I think from, you know, you were talking about, you know, this tension that sits within the South, you know, and thinking about refreshing the grief, I think, is a really interesting concept. And thinking about the UK, we don't have open caskets. It's not, you know, the family might go to the funeral direction very in a very private way and visit, but that's not a public event by any stretch of the imagination. Whereas, you know, the understanding is that in America, it can be a public event and that lots of people
will go. Yeah.
But there's also a sense of what's appropriate at those occasions, you know, to get it right is really quite important.
Yeah. So refreshing the grief was, you know, people would in rural areas especially, but I still see it happen now, is they would have the funeral at home, they would close the casket, and then they would walk to the cemetery, which is typically within walking distance, right? And they would open the casket up one more time and let everybody refresh. The psychological release is actually quite healthy when you stop and think about it, particularly for Southerners who were very practical, had a lot of work to do, who said, okay, we've grieved, I need to move on. And so there's a healthiness there. But what's also really interesting is that at the end of World War II, when those soldier bodies came back, families across the South, and I've since learned, not just in one place, but in many places, people were opening up the caskets once again to say goodbye and refresh the grief. And the stories in the book are from the escort records, military escort records for the state of Mississippi. But I have been getting into some World War II documents recently. And there's a woman from Alabama who said, well, when my son comes home, he was a parachutist with the 88th Infantry. And when he comes home, I'm going to have to open up the casket to make sure that he was put away decent. And this letter was written in 1947. And she says, signs the letter, yours for world peace. Right. You know, because she's well aware that the Cold War is beginning to emerge. Her son's body is part of the negotiations that are going on at the time as they're trying to get bodies home from Russia and Germany and all those other places.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, I mean, how it's very, because I've kind of almost been imbued in sudden death now for a few months, reading about it quite a lot and thinking about how it contrasts with northern states. And sometimes I wonder how practices travel from one place to another. You know, with the repatriation of bodies, then you would get, and as you were talking about yourself, you know, how certain sort of the mixture of people from different parts of America within aircraft crews and the notion that you would have northern soldiers coming to southern states and seeing this response to the body coming back and how they thought about that as being, would they regard that as particularly southern, or was this something that happened in northern states as well, this notion of keeping the not a thing?
You know, well, one of the things that I say in the book is that, you know, the truism isn't that everybody dies. The truism is that everybody dies and produces a lot of paperwork. So being able to, except when Northern soldiers were bringing bodies back during World War II, and to a lesser extent, World War I, but also because of the progressive reform movements that people in the South were actively engaging with their Northern peers, it's really difficult to see the ways some of these issues that I find in the South manifest in the North. And in fact, this is more of a research agenda rather than a set of stable conclusions, because everybody dies and leaves a lot of paperwork. And so, but those intrusions, particularly with wartime death, are really essential, because the U.S. military, particularly its funereal section called the part of the Quartermaster Corps, they're going to do things their way. And, you know, you laid out really nicely that, you know, a funeral is a set of legal practices, a set of material culture, and then a ritual. Well, the legal stuff stuff with the U.S. military is significant.
Right.
And causes a lot of changes in the South because this is how it's done by the military. And the families want the honor from the military. So one of the things that changes is people become more accustomed to requesting a cemetery stone.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got one free, no matter when you died.
Right.
If you were a World War I soldier. Or a World War II one as well. But by then, the practice had become more common. And so it's common in the South, and I'm sure in the North too, to see a family-chosen stone now. But there's also the World War II stone or World War I stone on the same plot because they want both.
Yeah. And I think in the UK, it's interesting to see how the kind of the war grave aesthetic creates a really strong appetite for almost a democracy in death, that everybody should have a stone.
Yes.
Why should everybody, why should we, you know, there was a sort of a sense in which the Victorian sort of obsession with status was no longer a modern thing. You know, we're moving on now, and that everybody should have a stone. And okay, they're modest, but everybody has one.
Yep.
So it kind of feel, it fits with the notions of welfare states, you know, that everybody.
Yeah.
I was really intrigued by how writing about how the military, how do you think, I'm trying to think whether did it tread carefully or did it just charge on through the racial divides, you know, saying, you know, the sensitivities that sat around the desire to have segregated responses and the notion that actually in the war cemeteries that were being created by the US military, that segregation was simply not visible.
So World War I and World War II are two vastly different experiences, in part because the Americans we Americans didn't show up for the war in 1917. And according to British and French leadership, quite late in the game. But for us, it was really the first time with World War I that we had been involved globally in a war in a meaningful way. And it required the U.S. military to draft a very, very large army. 4 million guys were eventually drafted. But to give you a sense of how small the military was beforehand, I don't know the numbers before the war, but after the war, U.S. military was 135,000 people.
Wow.
And the leadership, the generals and the colonels and all of that, tended to be Southern. Mm-hmm. And so the practices in the military, not all, obviously, but the practices in the military reflected Southern thinking to the extent that there's an article in the New York Times this morning about a group of, I believe, 52 Black soldiers who were at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. And there was a fight and 17 of them were hung. A form of military approved lynching, which is a very Southern tool. In a democracy, if you're going to fight a war for democracy, which is how Woodrow Wilson sold it to the American people, the ultimate democracy is in death.
And
you get a plot, you get a stone, your family is treated the same ish. As much as possible. So Black families started to see, you know, they see this and, you know, they're not dumb. They're making these connections, dying for democracy. I don't get democratic rights. And so the military, there's one in England. There's a bunch in Belgium and France. I've been to Saint-Avold to see that one. Those military cemeteries were set up after World War I as an option for soldiers and families. The majority of Southern families brought their boys home, not all.
Right.
And some of the photos that I have in the book are, but what if they were left there? They buried without regard to race. They buried without regard to religion. And in the South, where the Presbyterians were separated from the Methodists, that's huge.
Yes. Yeah.
A lot of those decisions were passé by World War II. So the last chapter, the last two chapters talk about two soldiers, and one of them was a Tuskegee Airman. whose dad was dean of students at Fisk University here in Nashville. William J. Faulkner Jr., senior, was at Fisk. And I went and visited his grave. Billy Faulkner crashed after 56 missions in a P-51 Mustang. And the P-51 Mustangs and the P-47s were the, I call them the attack posse, were the big lumbering bombers. The B-24 bombers were not agile planes. And so these P-51 Mustangs, these folks were the ones who were making sure the bombers got to their targets. And they were so good and so effective that the Luftwaffe had to rethink its entire flight strategy for the war. And Billy Faulkner flew 56 missions, not including a bunch of reconnaissance stuff to find pilots who didn't come back. And his dad wrote letters saying to the military, I want him buried. He fought for democracy, and I want him buried democratically, but not on German soil.
Right.
Which is really poignant. So if you go see Billy, Captain Faulkner's grave in Saint-Avold, France, you can tell if he's black or not. There's another Tuskegee Airman in that in that cemetery. It's William J. Faulkner Jr., captain.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. And so his dad, that's what he wanted. That's what his dad wanted. And I really like the fact that the military said, okay.
Yeah. I think we get in the UK rather less in the way of cooperation, you know, from the military, because the decision was made not to repatriate after the First World War. And the stories now are beginning to be told about how families responded to that and the existence of, you know, lobby groups and unions against that measure of women trying to get their sons back to say, you can't, you know, and I think we're only beginning to tell that story.
But think about British history versus American history in terms of global warfare, that there's precedent, you know, we could think of the defeat of the Spanish Armada back way back, that there are people, that British soldiers have been all over the globe fighting wars. American soldiers identifying as American is relatively, at least comparatively, new. Sure, there's a little bit with the Spanish-American War in the 1890s, but really there's different assumptions in the military, the British military, about what happens to those bodies versus an American military. And it's also in that shift with World War One. It's also, how do you keep people invested in the war effort? If you tell them their bodies aren't coming back, you're going to have a problem.
Yeah, yeah. It's a completely different sort of like rhetorical strategy, isn't it?
Yeah. You know,
I'm thinking about, I think the feeling was that if we started to bring bodies home, particularly in the First World War, it would be so bad for morale.
Yeah.
You know, to see this trail of hundreds of thousands of bodies coming back that it couldn't be borne. It just couldn't, people couldn't bear it. So it's interesting sort of thinking about it in those terms.
Julie, just so you know, when I teach World War One versus World War Two, of course I bring up mortality statistics. Mm-hmm. World War One, 900,000 British soldiers died. Mm-hmm. In World War Two, 200,000 died. So first of all, there's something different going on in terms of health and wellness. But it also was a different war. And so those ideas that train of funeral caskets in World War One, it was bad enough as it was without seeing 900,000 caskets.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, can we just, we're kind of running out of time, but I just want one tiny little more comment from you about the Spanish flu. So what's absolutely fabulous about your book, what I really like about it, because it integrates a history of the Spanish flu with this general, and I think this epidemic, this massively, the epidemic is really only we're just beginning to recognize it as this point in history. And you kind of integrate it into an understanding of what happens after the war. Do you think then, I mean, it's a strange question to ask, do you think we've underestimated, or do we overestimate the impact of the flu when we're thinking about the history of death? Do you think actually, once the flu had happened, things just went back to normal? Or do you think it had a longer term impact than that?
Okay, so from an American perspective, and understand, I get that this was a global phenomena that in best guesstimate term, 60 million people died. In the United States, best guesstimate, 600,000 people died. The way the literature reads, at least for historians of disease, not death, disease, is that World War I caused the Spanish flu.
Right.
In that, and again, this is an American-centric story here, and I believe that it actually is bigger.
Okay.
But the way it reads in the literature right now, that it started at Fort Riley, Kansas, a military training depot in spring of 1918. It went overseas during the summer of 1918 with those soldiers and underwent some sort of evolutionary turn. It migrated, and that's the deadly second wave. It migrated back to Fort Devens near Boston, Massachusetts in September 1918. And it's the very processes of war that makes everybody get Spanish flu. And the Spanish, not just in terms of how the bug evolved. And again, this is huge guesstimation here, but also how it was passed along, because it didn't separate troops away from everyday public in military parades. They had huge military parades, super spreader events.
Mm-hmm.
They put the soldiers on trains amidst civilian populations. And so it's the very processes of the war that make the flu possible. I think you're entirely correct that the 1920s were about the flu, about, you know, at least in the United States, there's a certain nihilism, you know, we're going to die tomorrow, so let's go party. So the flappers, because the thing about the flu is that it has a different mortality curve.
Mm.
The flu usually is a U curve, so babies and elderly, but this one had a W curve, babies, elderly, people 18 to 35, which is prime soldier material. These are young people who the life extension folks are saying, no, you're going to live to be an older person, and they're dying like flies.
Mm-hmm.
So that sense of demoralization, not just amongst the progressives, but because dying to them was a loss of sorts, not just a loss, but they lost. It's like a game. It was a game that they lost. But people who were 18 to 35 and saw all their friends and sisters and brothers and age peers die. It's there. Fighting that again, it's so much a part of everyday life that it's hard to tease that out.
Yeah.
It's when you get to the ritual that it becomes more obvious.
Yeah.
But what's the ritual in this case?
Yeah, it's all been so fascinating, and I'm sure we could talk for a lot longer. It's been so interesting to talk through some of these themes with you, and I'm so delighted by your book. I'm delighted by the way it draws together these very common narratives, the way it talks about theology and the way it builds health into the narrative of death, and the way it talks about these very specific rituals and customs and how they change over this period. And I just urge everybody to read it. I think that's how you kind of want to end.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks ever so much for speaking to me. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.